Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
A note before we start. This episode deals with suicide, and it may not be right for all listeners. From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. People get tattoos for a lot of reasons. But whatever they mean, or were meant to mean, they are a permanent mark commemorating a moment in time. Alana Dakin writes about two different tattoos in her essay. It's read this week by Zasha Mamet. Zasha is best known for her work on HBO's Girls, and her new show is Tales of the City on Netflix.
My boyfriend Andreas extended his forearm over his plate of half-eaten turkey and yams, fists clenched, exposing the Greek letters tattooed in dark blue ink from inner elbow to wrist. I took a hesitant bite of salad, still nauseated from the five-hour car ride from Manhattan to Lexington, Massachusetts, where Andreas's aunt and uncle were hosting the family's Thanksgiving meal. "It means nobody," Andreas told his cousin, who had spotted the new tattoo. His eyes were wet and alive. I already knew the story. It was Andreas's favorite part of the Odyssey. But I leaned in anyway, as he narrated the tale of when Odysseus and his men find themselves trapped in the cave of Polyphemus, a fearsome cyclops. The story goes that in a daring attempt at freedom, Odysseus tells the monster that his name is Nobody, and then plunges a wooden stake through Polyphemus's single eye, blinding him. The other giants on the island come running at the sound of Polyphemus's screams, but they soon turn back when the Cyclops explains that Nobody had hurt him. Andreas smiled. "You see?" he said. "Odysseus tricked them. He escaped." Less than 1 week later, I was sitting with Andreas's parents in their Tribeca apartment, looking through my phone for a photo of this same tattoo. We were drinking wine, even though it was the middle of the afternoon. By then, Andreas had been missing for over 48 hours. A blank email addressed to the detective assigned to Andreas's missing person case was open in front of me. The officer had asked us to send him a detailed physical description of Andreas, including photographs of his tattoos. This was to help the police put together his missing person flyer, or, if the time came, to identify the body. I had more or less moved in with Andreas's family since I found his suicide note on his bed 2 days before, along with his debit card, mailbox key, and rent check for the month. His phone was found later that night in the living room, his last text message sent to me just before leaving his apartment for the last time. "Goodbye. You're stronger than you know. I love you." These words ran wildly through my head as I sat in the back of a cab riding north on the FDR Drive, fielding calls from 911 agents and the Port Authority police. I answered the same questions over and over. 6'1", white, dark hair, a birthmark on his nose. "No, I don't know what he's wearing. Maybe 180 pounds? No, 160, 175. No, he doesn't have access to a vehicle." When they asked me for his birthday, I blanked and could remember only my former boyfriends. But he's 25, I said. Cheeks flushed. I didn't realize that the suicide note had a second page until I surrendered it to one of the Port Authority officers at their station in Fort Lee, New Jersey. I had stopped reading after the first line when I saw the words, "Take my life," written in his shaky scrawl at the top of the page. "I'm sorry, but we're going to have to keep this," the officer said, the bright light of the copying machine creating spots in front of my eyes as he scanned the pages. Later that night, I collapsed on the floor with Andreas's roommate and his roommate's girlfriend. We were drinking tequila straight from the bottle, too high on adrenaline to fully absorb the impact of the past few hours. "Can you believe," I remember saying to them, "that with just one phone call, we got a helicopter into the sky?" It seemed impossible that only 5 hours earlier, I had been deciding whether to order Thai or sushi. And now scuba divers were searching the Hudson River in the dark for my boyfriend. The seizing of the suicide letter was the first in a series of small but accumulating losses that rippled outward from that first seismic event. When his clothes lost their musk after a few days, I took the bottle of cologne from his dresser. In moments of panic, when I thought I was beginning to forget the tenor of his voice, I would listen to old voicemail messages, especially the ones in which he said he loved me. The night of his disappearance, I had stripped off my clothes and searched my body for evidence of him, a bruise or even a scratch, but found nothing. I also went through his trash, collecting the Macy's tags from the outfit he bought to wear to Thanksgiving, and old receipts from the diner we frequented on lazy Saturday afternoons. I kept these items tucked haphazardly in the pockets of my purse and jacket, making sure that I had a physical connection to him on me at all times. In the beginning, I would get drunk and post desperate pleas to him on Twitter late at night in case he got online. As time passed, I switched to writing him emails, which felt about as hopeless as flinging a bottle with a message into the sea. I sent him lists of all the things we had planned to do together. Go skydiving, learn how to roast a whole chicken, travel to Greece so I could see his family's village. Even though I lost hope that he was reading my emails as the weeks passed, writing to him before I fell asleep was one of the only things that calmed me. In one of those emails, I told Andreas that I'd started going to therapy. He had been pressuring me to find a therapist for months after I'd gone through a bad experience at the end of the summer. Putting this incident in the past was something that I was both ready and able to do, but my willingness to compartmentalize concerned him. Andreas had found his own therapist online, and every week he would send me links to different doctors, usually middle-aged Jewish women, and urge me to follow up. He fixated on one in particular, a woman named Carol, who he had decided would be the perfect fit. "Have you called Carol yet?" he would ask at least once a day. I made excuses, telling him that it didn't make sense because my insurance was about to run out, or that working two jobs would make scheduling a regular appointment impossible. One time, I surrendered and played therapist with him, sprawling on the couch while he asked me questions in a woman's falsetto. When he finally got me to confess one of my deepest insecurities, he became so upset by what I said that he jumped on top of me. "I hope Carol doesn't do this," I said, as he kissed my neck furiously. As it turned out, he had been right. I did love therapy. I counted the days to my weekly appointments, and I don't know that I could have survived that winter without them. But therapy hadn't changed the fact that I was wildly successful at acting normal while my world was unraveling. Everyone thinks I'm doing so well, and I guess I am, I wrote to Andreas in one of my last emails. But I want to break things all the time. I fantasize about smashing store windows or screaming at people. Sometimes I think about hitting you and pulling your hair, but it always just turns into me kissing you anyway. Andreas's body was pulled from the East River 2.5 months after he disappeared, only a few days shy of what would have been our one-year anniversary. In his suicide note, he had written that he wanted his ashes scattered in the Mediterranean Sea when the time was right. Against both Greek and Jewish tradition, his family cremated the body. In the summer, they traveled to Greece, as they do every year, and released Andreas's ashes into the sea at sunrise. The next day, I went to a tattoo parlor with my sister in the East Village, only minutes from where Andreas used to live. After a few painful minutes, it was complete. The word "somebody," written in Greek script, running vertically down my back. My therapist, a middle-aged Jewish woman, had been skeptical about my intention to get the tattoo. "Do you think you will want that reminder in bed with you when you're with another man one day?" she asked. "I don't know," I told her. A few months later, I would wake up with the sun next to a man I barely knew somewhere in central Harlem. I lay still to stave off the hangover and thought about how I felt completely unburdened for the first time in months. As I got up to use the bathroom, I caught my naked body in his full-length mirror. I turned sideways so that I could see the tattoo, which seemed smaller than I remembered. And I smiled.
That's Zasha Mamet reading Alana Dakin's essay, A Tattoo for the Living. We'll catch up with Alana after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
It's been about 2.5 years since Alana Dakin's essay was published, and more than 4 years since Andreas died. She says her tattoo was the second half of a pair that Andreas wanted to get.
I remember when I met him, he told me that one day when he was older that he intended to get a second tattoo on his left arm, which would say somebody in Greek. And my understanding was that it was a tattoo he wanted to get when he felt that he had made something of himself, when he was more established in the world, maybe after he had his first child. And he was never able to get this tattoo. And I decided that I wanted to get the tattoo as a remembrance for him, and also as a way to signify how important he was to me and the impact that he would have on me for the rest of my life.
And Alana told us more about the last year of Andreas's life.
It was hard because I had been the main figure in his life for the months up until he died. And I saw a lot of the pain that he was going through. And a lot of it I didn't see because he really hid it a lot. And I tried to explain as much of that to his family as I could. And Andreas's family was incredibly supportive of me throughout this entire experience. We really weren't that close, actually, until after he first went missing. And I don't really know what I would have done if I didn't have them. They welcomed me completely into their home, and I felt deeply connected to them, and still do.
Alana went with Andreas's family to Greece after his death. The trip brought her some peace. She was also in the process of converting to Judaism when he died. Saying Kaddish, the prayer said after the death of a loved one, was an important part of her grieving process. And another thing that helped Alana heal was New York City itself. It was a place she had first explored with Andreas, who was a New York City native.
He showed me everything, and so much of this city felt like him to me. And after he died, sometimes it was difficult. It was sort of overwhelming because I really wanted to feel connected to him. And so I used to go to the places that we used to go to. And over time, things changed, places disappeared. I remember one time, probably at least a year after he had passed away, and I wanted to go to the coffee shop that we had always gone to, and I was going to go there, and I was just going to get a coffee and sit in the window and just feel however I wanted to feel. And then I went there, and it was gone. And I was sad and also a little bit relieved, because I think that it just shows you the city doesn't let you mourn. You have to move on. And I think that that's another thing in Jewish tradition that I connect to very strongly, is that there's set periods for mourning. You say Kaddish for 30 days. It doesn't mean that you're not going to continue to mourn later, but something has to shift. You have to shift your relationship to that person's memory and to how you're going to deal with it.
That shift took time. But about 2 years ago, Alana did meet someone new.
I recently got engaged to a really wonderful person who I met about 2 years ago. And almost maybe the first or second day after we met, he ended up finding the story online and read it. It's, you know, a living part of who I am. I've always been very thankful that he's very supportive and understanding of that.
Alana and her fiancé lived in Jerusalem for a year. They just moved back to New York. She says that revisiting her essay and moving back to the city brought up a lot of old emotions about Andreas.
I'm coming back in such a secure place and a much healthier place. It's been really nice to reflect on that time. And I think one thing that has changed about my memory of him is that I am able to draw a lot more on the positives than I was before. I think after he died, it was really hard for me to not feel very overwhelmed by the negative parts of our relationship and the darkness that he had fallen into. And I think that now I really am able to focus more on the good things and to think about all of the beauty that he brought into the world. It's interesting, I think, when someone's no longer here, how do people keep them alive, and how much do you keep them a part of you, and how much do you have to let go? I very much want to keep him alive because he was just this really, just utterly unique, really passionate, really beautiful person. You know, it's a tragedy that he's not here anymore. And I want as many people as possible to continue to feel his energy and feel inspired by him.
That's Alana Dakin. She's a writer and Jewish educator based in New York. More after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Here's Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times.
I'm always intrigued by this poignancy of people trying to figure out how much to let go and how much to hold on. It becomes this sort of calculus of grief, like how much should you continue feeling connected to that person through things or through memories, and how much is it healthier to let go? And for me, Alana's piece just sort of strikes this almost perfect balance at the end where she decides upon this tattoo running down the middle of her back. The message of it is so affirming and universal, to have this message, somebody running down her back. I don't know, that moment just really soared for me. It's the kind of thing that can take an essay that's about so many different things and is wrestling so much into so few words and just take it to this place where it reaches another level and is sort of instructive to people who are wrestling with a similar thing.
And here's Zasha Mamet.
The piece didn't feel as if she was writing something asking for sympathy. It felt like she just wrote from a place of, like, almost purging her sadness into this piece, but in such a vulnerable and brave way. And then it's not overtly tied in a bow at the end at all, but there is this uplifting moment where she decides to not let this experience define her, that she's going to move forward. And it just felt so simple and powerful at the same time, you know, because clearly this horrific thing has happened to her, but somehow it doesn't feel like the overarching topic of the piece once you get to the end, which I feel like is a very hard thing to do as a writer. And I was just so moved and so impressed by it. And it just felt so unique and special.
Thanks again to Zasha Mamet for reading this week's piece. Her new show is Tales of the City on Netflix. Next week, Jessica Walter.
Okay, I admit it. I suffer from ageism. I find myself buying into our cultural concept of age, which says I'm ugly now, a hag. I'm a product of my culture and of the advertising that swirls around us, presenting beauty as a 19 or even 16-year-old, perhaps.
in Victoria's Secret lace or a Calvin Klein string thong with her bee-stung lips and sulky face. And look, she is beautiful. She is breathtaking. Why is it that a man can be desirable his whole life long and a woman can't?
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Caitlin O'Keefe. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Our intern is Shemi Aloko. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Special thanks to Julia Simon, Anya Stremian, and Mia Lee at The New York Times. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Additional music, courtesy of APM. And if you love the podcast, rate us on Apple Podcasts or tell your friends about it. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.